Fellows Incorporated against Shengzhou Yinrei Fellows. Mr. Jackson.
Good morning, Your Honors.
May it please the Court. George Jackson on behalf of defendant appellant, which I'll call the joint venture, Judge.
Well, you'll call them
the joint venture.
Okay.
For simplicity
That's
purposes.
Easier to pronounce.
Yes, far easier.
I mean, I apologize for massacring your client's name if that's what I did to it.
No, actually you did not, Judge. It's me that I'm worried about massacring. Your Honor, this comes before the Court on diversity jurisdiction basis. And we'll start out, of course, with my argument with addressing the diversity jurisdiction. As this Court is well aware, federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction. The plaintiff has the responsibility to prove the existence of jurisdiction by preponderance
right.
of the evidence.
That I understand. And I certainly understand your position, and I will be asking Mr. Franklin in detail about this. I have a particular question for you, which is, does the record show the citizenship, assume that the joint venture is a limited liability company or acts like a limited liability company, do we know from the record the citizenship of all members of the limited liability company, of the joint venture?
No, we know the allegation of the joint venture partners, of which there are only two. And their allegations that they are themselves a limited liability company, which is the Shinru.
Right, so we then have to trace through however many levels there are.
Precisely. And we have that the Fellows Hong Kong is a company, whatever that means, a company organized under the laws of Hong Kong with a representation that its principal place of business is in Hong Kong as well. You know, I guess addressing the question, and I'll deviate a bit from my prepared speech, as it were, and say that part of the problem that we have here is that the record simply is woefully insufficient. And it's insufficient for us to address this very important foundational issue, which is one of jurisdiction. It's unfortunate that the court did not, in seeking to enter and even consider the injunction, address whether it had sufficient jurisdiction to proceed forward. And it's more troubling, Your Honor, because the court recognized that there was a problem. The court said, wait a minute, so in speaking to Mr. Franklin, what you're doing is essentially that your client is suing one of his subsidiaries. Well, if you have a parent company suing one of his subsidiaries and it's in federal court based on diversity jurisdiction, that begs the question of making sure that whether you have complete diversity. That simply never took place. Continuing my deviation, Your Honor, what we've been able to establish, just from public record, by documents that we've obtained from our clients, which are not part of the record, Your Honor, Judge Easterbrook, in response to your question, it's not part of the record, but documents that we've obtained, strongly suggesting that the nerve center of Fellows Hong Kong is located in Itasca, Illinois. Those are documents that the court should be able to consider, which this court should be able to consider in assessing whether there is in fact jurisdiction, whether there is in fact diversity jurisdiction, whether there is complete diversity. So our position, cutting to the chase as it were, is that there simply is not enough before this court to make the final determination of whether there is complete diversity. Now, having said that, getting back to the prepared portions of my presentation, it's the responsibility of the plaintiff to have established that and have to do so by preponderance of the evidence, as Judge Eastbrook acknowledges. And they just simply fell woefully short to that end. one of the things that I want to make clear, which I'm sure this court is well aware, that the burden does not rest with us. But because of the posture in which we're now presenting and addressing this issue for the first time, is on appeal, it would seem to suggest that we now have the burden of disproving. And in fact, some of the arguments that have been espoused by plaintiff's counsel would tend to suggest that we have the burden of disproving that diversity jurisdiction exists, when it's not our burden. The burden rests with them in its entirety, and it doesn't shift. In starting to address that issue, Your Honor, we start out with the fact that, admittedly, Fellows United U.S. is a corporation, and its principal place of business is located here in Illinois. It's operated and organized out of Illinois. It's a citizen of Illinois. Therefore, we don't have complete diversity if the joint venture also has citizenship here in Illinois, regardless of where else it may have citizenship, in China, Hong Kong, wherever. If it also has citizenship here in Illinois, there is not complete diversity. This court lacks jurisdiction, as did the district court lack jurisdiction. Unfortunately, fortunately for our clients, but unfortunately for the courts and unfortunately for the plaintiff, their pleadings simply allege that the joint venture is a company organized under Chinese law and operating with its principal place of business in China, without any analysis of why, whether this should be treated, this entity, this joint venture foreign entity, should be treated as a corporation or as an unincorporated association of some sort. Of course, as your honors know, and I always feel somewhat reticent or reluctant to tell the cite the statutes to the courts, but as your honors know that if it is a corporation, if in fact it's a corporation, then it takes its citizenship from its place of incorporation coupled with its principal place of business. But if it's not a corporation, if it is instead a unincorporated organization or an association, then it takes its we have to look at whether it is the type of entity that ought to be treated like a corporation or ought to be treated like a unincorporated association. If the latter, then the entity, in this case the joint venture, takes its citizenship from its members or its owners, of which there are two here. And the two owners are Xinri, which is an entity operating under the laws of China, and Fellows Hong Kong, which is an entity operating under the laws of Hong Kong. Even in addressing the individual owners, Your Honor, plaintiffs fail to identify whether these are corporate entities or are they entities that are unassociated organizations, unincorporated associations as well, which is problematic because now we have to address that issue not knowing. Because if in fact they are unincorporated associations, which is our position that they are, then you have to look to where its owners are residents, are citizens. Assuming that Fellows Hong Kong is a corporation, which we challenge, that there's not a sufficient basis on which to make that conclusion, but even assuming that they are a corporation, Your Honor, the question then becomes, where is their principal place of business? In their principal place of business, they allege, is in Hong Kong, but they provide this court, they provided the lower court with nothing to establish that. Instead, what Your Honor has are those things that we now are that we refer to that shows that people who run Fellows Hong Kong are people that are also members of or employed by Fellows U.S. Those people are located in Itasca, Illinois. We have no evidence or any documentation of any sort whatsoever that reflects that there's any operation in Hong Kong. All operations are emanating from China. From Itasca, Illinois. That's insufficient basis, Your Honor. That shows that there is not sufficient diversity jurisdiction. Now, in response to that, plaintiffs argue about this juridical person. and they make the argument that the juridical person, they use it synonymous with a corporation. But the juridical person, Your Honor, is not a corporation. Once, even if there's a decision that an entity is a juridical person, you still have to make the determination whether that juridical person ought to be treated like a corporation or as an unincorporated organization. The case on which it relies predominantly to that end, Your Honor, is the Puerto Rico case, Puerto Rico v. Russell case. And even in the Puerto Rico v. Russell case, there's a reference to whether this is a juridical person. But then the court spends from the bottom of page 480 all the way up to almost page 482 listing all of the attributes of its corporateness. And then it concludes with a line that that personality is so complete in contemplation of the law of Puerto Rico that we can see no adequate reason for holding that the Sociedad has a different status for purposes of federal jurisdiction than a corporation organized under the law, that law. In short, the operative question there was not whether it was juridical, because after doing this litany of cases and showing its corporateness, it then concluded that it is a corporation, as opposed to simply concluding that it was a juridical person. I want to address now, I see I'm eating into my rebuttal time. I want to just briefly address, Your Honor, if I may, the issue, the substantive issue on which we're on appeal, which is the issue relating to service of process. And our position is simple, and I'll put this briefly so I can reserve at least a minute or so for rebuttal time. Our position is that you cannot have an injunction entered, a preliminary injunction entered, without service of process. Counsel relies on Rule 65 for a position that notice is sufficient, that's all you need in order to enter an injunction. Because of the shortness of time, I'd like to bring the court's attention to the Baja case, the National Spiritual Assembly case of Baja. In brief terms,
that's a permanent injunction case.
That's correct, Judge. That's correct.
We're at the preliminary injunction stage, so it's governed by Rule 65, which says notice is all you need.
That's precisely. And the issue with that case, Your Honor, is that a permanent injunction had already entered, as you just identified. And the court found that with the permanent injunction, you have to have had the party to either been a party or to have given notice.
Or in privity. That was a case about privity.
That's correct, Judge.
For purposes of enforcing the permanent injunction against a non-party. That really doesn't have any bearing here. What we're concerned about here is the requirements for the issuance of a preliminary injunction. And that doesn't require that service of process be perfected, only that there's notice. That's what the HD case, HD Michigan case said.
That's right.
Right, so we're squarely within that rule, I think.
Well, we take the position that the HD case, Your Honor, for the reason we articulated in our brief, is wrongly decided. I'm not sure how much time I have left. I do want to spend leave time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Jackson.
All right.
Mr. Frank.
May it please the Court. My name is Richard Franklin. I represent the plaintiff appellee, Fellows Incorporated. Your Honor has already suggested that there is going to be a question as to whether we adequately raised and proved up the issue of subject matter jurisdiction in the district court. The fact is, we adequately alleged subject matter jurisdiction in the complaint that we filed.
The complaint alleges that the defendant is a limited liability company.
Correct.
And if that's what it is, then we need to know the citizenship and principal place of business of every member and of every member's member. The complaint doesn't allege that. And if I understand your brief correctly, you are not contending that if we go through the different levels of membership, there will be complete diversity. You are instead relying on Russell for the proposition that every juridical entity has its own citizenship and principal place of business for the purpose of diversity jurisdiction. Am I understanding you correctly?
No, sir, Judge Easterbrook. I take issue with a number of the points you just made. We alleged.
Make sure I understand you correctly.
We alleged that the defendant was a limited liability company, not a U.S. limited liability company, but a company organized under the laws of China.
Does it have alienable shares?
Pardon me?
Does it have alienable shares?
It issues shares, Your Honor. I believe there are restrictions upon the transfer of shares.
As a matter of law or as a matter of private contract?
I believe that's a matter of contract, Your Honor, as it could be in a U.S. company as well. A U.S. company does not necessarily have to have alienable shares.
I don't think corporation. A U.S. limited liability company or a U.S. limited partnership has alienable shares as the off-the-rack term. That's the question, or it's a central question, and I certainly, maybe I've misunderstood your brief. I do not understand your brief to be arguing that this Chinese entity has alienable shares.
Your Honor, we don't believe that that is the single factor to look to.
You may not believe it, but this court believes it. Mm-hmm. We've said so several times. That's what distinguishes limited liability companies from corporations. And therefore, we need to, if we were to place this on the side, is it more like a corporation, which has alienable shares, or more like a limited liability company, which does not, under U.S. law? It looks like it's on the LLC side of the line. That's why I say I understood your argument to be relying on this juridical personhood contention. But you say I've misunderstood you. So I'll shut up for a while and let you spell out your real argument.
Your Honor, my understanding is that the alienation of the shares is limited and requires the approval of the Chinese government. However,
yes,
we still believe...
That pretty surely means it's not a corporation.
Well, I would disagree with that, Your Honor. There are all the other factors point to this being very similar to a U.S. corporation. It's a limited liability company organized under the laws of China. We have attached to our brief the limited liability company law as an effect in China. We can see from this law that the defendant has all the important attributes of a U.S. corporation. For one thing, the company law expressly provides in Chapter 2 that a company organized thereunder will be incorporated. We further see from the company law that the Chinese limited liability company is a legal person separate from its shareholders, that its shareholders have limited liability, and it has the capacity to own property and file suit.
How is any of this different from a limited liability company under U.S. law? Limited liability company in U.S. law has legal personhood. The investors have limited liability. I mean, you can tick off everything you've said about this entity, other than arguments about the alienability of shares, seems to me to be true of the business trust, the limited liability company, and the limited partnership. And all three of those entities have been held not to be corporations.
Well, Your Honor, one factor I did not yet tick off is that the Chinese limited liability company is to be managed by a board of directors and not directly by its owners, as is generally the case with regard to the U.S. limited liability company.
The general partner manages the limited partnership. The limited partners have no say. But, of course, Cardin against Arcoma Associates, a decision your brief doesn't even mention, holds that does not require it to be treated like a corporation. Cardin holds that the citizenship of every limited partner counts, even though a limited partner has no role whatsoever in governance and can't have any.
Your Honor, our
brief sounds like the dissent in Cardin.
Your Honor, our position is that the attributes of a corporation are here. A limited liability company under U.S. law, I think the real story there is that, of course, a partnership, a general partnership, was always considered an unincorporated institution. A limited partnership is the same as a general partnership, except that certain of the partners have limited liability. Therefore, it's treated the same way. The Chinese limited liability company does not have that history. And I would add, Your Honor, a limited liability company under U.S. law is really a partnership. It's really a limited partnership without a general partner. And I think that has been the justification for treating all of those as unincorporated associations. In China, the story is quite different. The act under which the defendant is organized is the corporate law in China. This is the law in China under which corporations are organized. It talks about corporations being incorporated under the act. And I do believe, Your Honor, that all the factors that are vital for being a corporation are present with respect to a Chinese limited liability company. And they would meet the corporate resemblance test, as has been articulated in a number of these courts' decisions, the White Pearl decision, the Learjet decision, and the Supro Sequoia decision. But I believe, in addition, Your Honor, it meets the distinct juridical entity test, which was articulated in the Puerto Rico versus Russell case, but also followed in this court's decision in Otto Cephalus.
And the Supreme Court said in Cardin that that Russell was confined to particular Puerto Rico entities. Our decision in the Greek Orthodox case preceded Cardin. You have a decision of the Supreme Court which says that Russell applies to Puerto Rico entities only, and your brief doesn't even cite Cardin. What impression do you think that leaves on the Court of Appeals?
Your Honor, if I may, I believe the Otto Cephalus case was decided a few months after Cardin. I may be incorrect, but I believe that that is the case. It has never been overruled by this Court.
Of course it's never been overruled. It's been confined to its facts.
It has been
You want us to treat it as a general statement of the rule for identifying a corporation, and the Supreme Court has held that it is not the general statement of the rule for identifying a corporation.
Well,
we are going to follow Cardin. You can rely on it. And that means we are not going to give Russell the significance you find there.
Well, I hear, Your Honor. I would point out the statement in Cardin was dictum, but I do hear what Your Honor is saying. And I still believe that the Chinese limited liability company should qualify as a corporation under the corporate resemblance test. And even if it doesn't, Your Honor, we would then look to the owners of the defendant. We agree upon that. And to their citizenship. One of those owners, without question, is a Chinese company with its principal place in business in China. The second owner is a Hong Kong company. This case was filed early in 2011, before the recent amendments to the diversity statute, which for the first time granted dual citizenship to foreign corporations. As a result of that, the Hong Kong entity, which is a Hong Kong corporation, would be given the citizenship of only Hong Kong, because the amendment to the diversity statute was not in effect as of the date that this suit was filed. And the amendment specifically provided that it does not have retrospective effect. The history of this dual citizenship is a bit interesting. Until 1958, corporations had only the citizenship of the state or foreign country where they were organized. In 1958, Congress for the first time granted domestic corporations dual citizenship. In 2011, for the first time, Congress granted foreign corporations dual citizenship. But the fallback rule, the default rule, prior to the enactment of those two amendments to the statute, is that a corporation only has the citizenship of its place of incorporation. And for the Hong Kong entity, which is an owner of defendant, that is Hong Kong. Unless there are other questions about jurisdiction, I would like to turn briefly to the merits.
What is the current status of service? Has the defendant been served under the convention yet?
Your Honor, we have repeatedly made inquiry of the Chinese authorities with respect to service. They tell us that they are unable to affect service. Our understanding is that this is not uncommon with respect to efforts to make service through the Chinese authorities. We have filed a motion in the district court relying upon a provision in the Hague Service Convention which states that if service has been tried but can't be made, the district court can...
You're thinking Article 15, Paragraph 3?
Yes, sir. The court can deem service to be made.
Has the court said that that extends for a period of years? Article 15, Paragraph 3 allows urgent relief to precede service. Your view seems to be that relief can precede service forever.
No, that's two different issues, Your Honor.
We're 2 years into this case.
That's two different issues, Your Honor, and I misspoke when I said that our motion recently filed in the district court relies upon Article 15, Subsection 3. That goes only to relief such as a temporary injunction or preliminary injunction. In order to get permanent relief, of course you must have service. There is another provision of the Hague Service Convention, which we are now relying on the district court, which says if you have gone a long time and you have not been able to achieve service, the district court may deem service to have been affected.
Which one is that?
Your Honor, I would have to look at the convention to get the section number. I don't have it in my head.
That's rather important because Article 15, Paragraph 3 seems to me a weak read. If there is some better basis, we really need to know it.
If there's some other basis?
That's the basis you've been talking about.
Well, the alternative basis, Your Honor, requires a waiting period.
Yeah, well, waiting period seems to be the name for this litigation.
I'm sorry, I don't have the provision at my fingertips, Your Honor. Perhaps Mr. Jackson would assist me here. That's very kind of you, sir. That's Article 15. It's Article 15, which says where a writ of summons had to be transmitted abroad for purpose of service and the defendant has not appeared, judgment shall not be established until the document was served. However, each contracting state is free to declare that a judge may enter judgment if the document was transmitted by one of the methods provided for in the convention. A period of time of not less than 6 months has elapsed, and no certificate has been received from the foreign authority. So we had to wait at least 6 months to avail ourselves of that alternative provision for service.
And 6 months has long passed in this litigation.
It has, Your Honor. A good deal of time has passed.
I gather that 6 months passed before your client made its very first inquiry. The timeline filed in the district court says that the first inquiry came about 13 months after the first attempt at service.
I don't believe that's accurate, Your Honor. We have tried many times to inquire
about
service.
That's the document you filed in the district court. You don't believe your own document is accurate?
Your Honor, I would have to check the record on that. My recollection is we made frequent inquiry of the Chinese authorities with regard to service. We were always turned away by them and told that they were having difficulties in affecting that service. In any event, the relevance of that to the entry and the validity of the preliminary injunction.
Here's what your document says. On October 25, 2011, Fellows Council transmitted the summons and complaint to the responsible authority in China. On February 6, 2012, Fellows Council was informed by the responsible authority that it had transmitted the document to the relevant court but had not received notice of service. On October 2, 2012, Fellows Council contacted the authority to inquire. So it took Fellows Counsel almost a full year to make its first inquiry. At least this is according to Fellows' own filing in the district court. Now, it may be you haven't told the district court the full truth, but this is what you told the district court. I'm just quoting from it.
Well, Your Honor, again, the relevance of this to the entry and the validity of the preliminary injunction appears to me not really to be the case. The issue here is whether there was proper service or a substitute for service, which we believe was made, at the time the preliminary injunction was entered, which, of course, was fairly shortly after the filing of the suit. The issue of whether there is service in connection with
further proceedings. I think we have your position, Mr. Franklin. Court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further, Mr. Jackson?
Nothing, Your Honor.
Doesn't look like it. Thank you, Mr. Jackson, and we also thank you for providing the citation. The case is taken under advisement.